You're listening to the Youth Crit Podcast on KHZ Network. Find us on Facebook at DecibelUNG Radio and find us on Twitter at DecibelUNG. If you like this episode, please leave a like and comment on our iTunes page at KHZ Network. And now for the podcast.
In 1975, he directed Jaws. In 1978, he directed Close Encounters of the Third Kind. In 1981, he directed Raiders of the Lost Ark. And now, Steven Spielberg brings us E.T. the Extraterrestrial. We will witness the arrival.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Youth Critic Retrospective. This week, we are going to be talking about E.T. the Extraterrestrial for its 35th anniversary, as it came out on June 11th, 1982. And this was officially the last part of the Spielberg week for 1982, since the week prior to E.T. coming out, Poltergeist came out, and essentially that movie was so publicized that Spielberg, like, being so heavily behind the scenes, everyone thought they hailed it as, like, I think the summer of Spielberg. But anyway, you can learn more from you. But today I'm joined by Brandon Cooley to talk about E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Thanks, man, for being on the show.
Oh, yep, no problem.
Yes, thank you. So, to start things off, on every retrospective, we try to go through the production history of the movie to kind of, you know, add something new and different to the take. And so with this one, I'm going to start with, even though it kind of collates with what we talked about in Poltergeist, or what Patrick and Andy were talking about in Poltergeist. And so so some of this might sound like repeated info, but I'm going to try not to, you know, repeat some of the info we got from the Poltergeist podcast a couple weeks back. So starting in the late 70s, after Encounters of the Third Kind, Spielberg was working on a treatment for the movie called Night Skies, about a boy who had an alien friend from outside this world, and it was going to be a lot more, you know, scarier, more in tone with his Close Encounters of the Third Kind movie. But when he brought the project to Harrison Ford's wife at the time, I think it was his wife at the time, but either that or she will be Melissa Matheson. She proposed this idea of it being more of a kid's movie, being more, you know, kid friendly, and not being, you know, a scary, you know, thriller film that Spielberg had proposed. And essentially Melissa Matheson and Steven Spielberg worked on the movie. Well, Spielberg, was working on Poltergeist at the time, you know, writing the script and producing it and working with Tobe Hooper to get that movie going throughout the summer of 1981. Then finally in the fall of 1981, he shot it. They wrapped it before Christmas. And then they spent the next 5 months basically putting it together. And essentially made probably one of the biggest movies of cinema history, as it opened to massive critical acclaim at the Cannes Film Festival and with critics all around the world, and became a huge sensational hit. And next week we'll talk about what the impact it had on almost every movie that came out afterwards. But for now, Brandon, why don't you tell our listeners about how you got into E.T.?
Well, actually, E.T. was one of the first movies I ever saw. I don't remember it actually, but when I was three, my grandma basically sat me in front of the TV to watch E.T. She had the old VHS tape of it. And I just, apparently, I, from what I was told, I was just engrossed the whole time at the age of three watching it. And so really, it's one of the first movies I ever saw, along with Toy Story and Star Wars. It goes back that far for me. So yeah, I've always loved the movie. It's very nostalgic for me. And each time, it's one of those movies where each time I watch it, I always know something different about it. It has many ways to interpret it, not to interpret it, but many things to enjoy. It's not a simple movie by any means, even though the plot really does sound simple. So yeah, very nostalgic for me. When did you start watching it, or when did you first see it?
I first saw the movie when it was coming out around its 20th anniversary. So I was about 7 or 8 when I first saw the movie, and my parents tried to sit down and watch the movie with, they tried to like sit me down and watch it when I was 8, but I was so excited as like a 7 or 8 year old before it came out. Cause you have to understand, the movie was already out, at Blockbuster for rental. Yeah. For VHS rental at that time. So they were trying to like convince me to like, you know, you can watch the movie here and for like $2 or $3 instead of going, you know, I don't know how much ticket prices were back then, but it was probably like twice as much. So yeah, they were trying to convince me, but I was like 15 minutes in and I was like, no, I want to see this on a big screen. I want to see this, you know. So my experience with the movie was I went with my aunt's boyfriend. Sounds weird, but I went with my aunt's boyfriend at the time, because my parents definitely were not going to see the movie. And I think my aunt was going to go, but she had something to do. So my aunt's boyfriend, who was a really nice guy, really, really cool guy, but we sat and watched the movie, and it was for me, it was a heartbreaking, just, you know, beautiful experience, you know, sitting there as a 7-8 year old, fully captivated in everything that was going on, just totally, and being in tears when E.T. was, you know, dying, you know, in front of me in this big, you know, screen. So E.T., it means a lot to me as a child because it was one of the first movies where, along with movies like Shrek and Monsters University and Spider-Man and this movie.
You mean Monsters Inc.?
Monsters. Monsters Inc. Where I went, you know, where as a kid I fully understood like the importance of story and characters and how it makes an impact on people and how it makes an impact on... Yeah. On moviegoers. And so for me, this was a huge movie for me growing up and watching it a lot. Now, I haven't watched the movie since I was a teenager. So rewatching this movie last week was kind of an interesting experience, given that it's one of those movies where it's best when you're watching it as a kid. Like, it really is one of the best movies to watch as a kid because you're not as cynical or as like high up your ass is, you know, as most adults are.
I saw it in theaters at Movie Tavern. They did a retro night where they were playing E.T. around 1.5 years ago, maybe 2 years ago. Yeah, I wasn't too cynical about it. I mean, I had seen it probably 30 times by that point. Who knows? I mean, I saw it or used to watch it all the time as a kid. Mm-hmm. On VHS, but right. Watching it again, I mean, I still really enjoyed it, even knowing what was going to happen. I mean, just it's an all around just great movie in terms of the screenplay, acting, cinematography, just everything, really. I mean, what parts did you find, like, did anything age badly for it, or was anything like didn't work for you?
Nothing was bad or nothing. I mean, there's a couple effect shots that kind of, even in the 20th anniversary edition, which they really did clean up a lot of effects and whatnot.
That's always going to happen with old movies. I mean, that's not.
Yeah. It's just not, some of the effects didn't quite work as well as they used to. But it's still like, is a very well-made movie, very well shot by Alan DeVeo. Very well edited by not Michael Caine, who is Spielberg's usual editor, he was actually working on Poltergeist during the making of this movie.
Okay,
cool. So it's, I mean, it was just like, you know, I guess maybe because I don't know. It was just the whole E.T. coming back to life, like after the whole like traumatic experience. Like, I don't know, as an adult, I was like, so wait, how does this work now? It's like the logic in my brain was screaming, wait a second, how does this work? And so I don't know, maybe I am become too logical and too cynical, but it's still like a very well-made movie. It's still fantastic. And it's still like the magic is still there. And John Williams' score is just incredible. Like just in little scenes of like E.T. just listening in on the Peter Pan story and the music kind of just, the piano music just kind of playing in the background. It's just like spot on incredible. So
yeah, it's interesting because it's a movie that has no, even though it's a kid's movie and it sounds simple, it has no clear antagonist. That's a good thing. It has no obvious antagonist. That's another way to put it. Because, you know, you, at first you think it's the men in suits, the people from the government trying to find E.T.
Peter Coyote.
Yeah, well, you find out that he's the guy leading it at the end. But then they're trying to save E.T. You know, that he's sick, they're trying to save him. So they're not really the bad guys. So then you think, okay, so it's him trying to get home. But that's not really like the major conflict of the whole movie. So really the only part, what makes it so interesting is that the only like antagonist you could probably argue is the fact that their father left them. And that this is his solution to like connect with someone, to connect with someone.
This is his coping mechanism.
Yeah, basically that's the whole point of the movie. So that's really interesting. You know, it's not, it's a kid's movie, but adults I think can enjoy it too, because it is not simple. It's complex. The characters are very well written in that way. So.
Right. Well, and also, well, I mean, I guess in rewatching the movie last week, I saw that, I guess you can make an argument that the faceless like government officials that are chasing them are kind of the antagonists at the end, but really you're right. There is no antagonistic force. There really isn't. Exactly. Like, it's just everyone in their own right is a protagonist. They all have their own sort of goals. They have their own. Because even Peter Coyote, like he wants, you know, I mean, I'm sure like he's, you know, I'm sure he wants the alien to come back so he can like research and, you know, his day to where he can claim that there's another race out in the universe. But really, I mean, as you learn in the movie, he's been, you know, wanting, he had a connection to E.T. before.
Yeah, I was going to mention the 2 years ago watching in the theater again. One of the best scenes that stood out to me was when he's talking to Elliot and he says, you know, he's been waiting for this too since he was a kid to find alien life. And so you don't notice that when you're watching as a kid, but when you're an adult, you're watching it, and you're like, yeah, that makes sense that why he would be so keen on trying to find E.T., you know, that makes perfect sense. Stuff like that, you don't notice the first time watching it, you know. Or just the mom's performance, you know, just the, or her character, just the way she acts. It makes more sense when you watch it again, being older. Yeah, it's good that way. Now, I was going to mention too, I never was a big fan of Super 8. It came out in 2011. It was kind of disappointing to me because it made me think, do you think that a movie like E.T. could be made these days? Because Super 8 seemed like an attempt to make a movie like that.
I mean, yes. But the thing about Super 8 is, well, the thing about Super 8 is it has intact, well, even the villain of the movie, has his own goals. Like he is a his own protagonist. Like he has, and really if you watch Stranger Things, like that's pretty much the closest we'll get to anything E.T. I'm doing this in air quotes, listeners, in E.T. air quote, in E.T. like style.
Yeah.
So I think it's possible because I mean First of all,
I mean, I would say that Stranger Things reminds me of the Goonies, and Stand By Me, and it, like E.T. is much more like slower paced than those movies. It's not like it's a blockbuster. It's science fiction, but it's a drama. You know, it's not like action. It's not
right. Okay.
It's not a comedy. It's just a drama, basically, for kids. I mean, do you think a movie like that could be made these days? Does it rely on special effects or slapstick comedy? You know, something. You know what I mean? Like,
I mean, I'm sure you can, because you know, you bring it up. There's not a movie that doesn't have a lot of special effects. Like, you can make a movie like E.T., like very indie style, for next to nothing. Well, I don't mean next to nothing, but like, you know, maybe like a couple million dollars here and there. You can probably make an E.T.-esque movie, but on a studio level where there's like millions upon millions of dollars being spent and everything is now a cinematic universe and there's a lot of cynicism in our films. You know, even movies that don't have a lot of cynicism, they don't really do that well. So,
yeah. I think it's fascinating that there's not too many kids movies, like PG kids movies, that treat the kids watching it like with respect. I mean, because kids aren't crying by the end of this movie, or when, you know, E.T. supposedly dies. I mean, it is an emotional movie. And I just can't think of very many PG kids movies that are that well written, you know, like a lot of dramas, you know, just action adventure. There's very few.
Well, they're all either written by adults who either hate their kids or think they're trying to be cool with their kids, or they're like Professor Vines or they're like a screenwriting professor where they don't have kids, but they still will write stuff for kids' movies.
Yeah, yeah.
So we'll see. I think the problem is that, you know, I don't think it's a problem of cynicism coming in and attacking a movie. It's parents don't want their kids exposed to really heavy emotional stuff. I joke with you about your little brother Ryan being exposed to like R-rated movies and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But for kids today, like, it's, you know, it would be something if someone made a movie like E.T. or Poltergeist, or even like, you know, a movie that's like the Goosebumps TV show and made it like a little horror, like a little, like, you know, scary for kids.
Yeah.
And it come out and do very well. Like, it would be so, you know, culturally shocking, because I think the problem with children today is that they're not given the chance to be exposed to scary things.
Yeah. Well, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I mean, back in the 80s and 90s, like, they were like, we had, there were movies like The Dark Crystal and, you know, Labyrinth. And then we got the Goosebumps TV show. And then we got Are You Afraid of the Dark? I mean, we had stuff that, you know, scared children. And you know, we brought this up on, Patrick, Andy, and I brought this up on Poltergeist. But the thing is, there's not a lot of, you know, room for, not a lot of parents will take their kids to see, you know, horror movies. I think that's really sad.
Yeah, I think so too. I was thinking the closest example I could think of a modern movie that, like E.T., that's a PG movie written for kids, but also the adults can enjoy, and it's that's well written, is probably Hugo. But even that, though, is an adventure movie, and even though it's by my favorite director, I didn't think Hugo was like a great movie by any means. It was pretty good, but I just can't think of very many PG movies that still have that. It can capture adults, their interest, you know. There aren't very many these days. But yeah, I mean, you're right. I think that's too bad there aren't more horror movies that kids can enjoy. I think Krampus was one of them. That was pretty good. That was
a
movie that the whole family can enjoy. It's actually scary.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't mind, like, my I wouldn't mind my now almost 10-year-old cousin watching Krampus.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's no, I don't think there's any blood in the movie, and I don't think there's any, like, horrible things that happen to, like, you don't see the horrible things that happen to people. You just see them get taken away.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a fun movie. Like, there, it's not like, you know, it's kind of like Gremlins. It's a lot like Gremlins in that, there's a lot of goofy stuff that happens, but it's not like way too over the top intense. It's just, you know, it's just like that perfect compromise of, like, there's scary imagery, but there's also goofy, funny stuff in there as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So with that said, I mean, with E.T., what is its legacy? And I wanted to ask this, what is its legacy and why is it so with Spielberg? Like, why is it so attached to Spielberg so much?
Yeah, you're right, because it is one of the first ones we think of when we think of Spielberg. Yeah, I mean, he's made quite a few movies that have stood the test of time. I think E.T. has aged really well. I mean, you can watch it, and very few scenes have aged badly. But I mean, same thing with Raiders of the Lost Ark or Jurassic Park. But I think just the characters are what make people like E.T., not the most, but it's probably my second favorite by Spielberg. I think it's just the characters for me. Where does it rank for you in terms of Spielberg? Like,
oh God, never ask me this.
Never mind. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would say like a 5 or a 6.
Oh, really?
Well, here's the thing. Like, I think my like top 10, you can pretty much just whatever day I'm feeling, like I can move stuff up and down, just whatever I feel. But because I love, like, there's a good chunk of Spielberg movies that I really adore. Like, I love Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I mean, that movie, for me, that's his most well-made film, in my opinion.
Oh, really? Like that.
I mean, I know, you know, Jaws and Schindler's List and Saving Private Ryan, but I mean,
Schindler's List is my all-time favorite by him. I can't imagine any movie topping that he could ever make. I mean, it's Schindler's List, you know. It's not the one I watch the most, obviously, because I can only watch that movie once every 4 years because it's so intense. But
Schindler's List is in my top 5, but I've only seen that movie twice, and I can't.
Oh, me too. Yeah, I can't imagine.
Yeah, I can't imagine ever watching it again.
Because it's so difficult to watch. Yeah, I mean, but probably E.T. would be my second favorite. I'm not as big a fan of Jaws as most other people are. I mean, I love Jaws, but it's just not in my top 5. You know,
Jaws is like number 2 or 3 because I watch that movie every summer. And okay. I just, like, I love it so much that my nitpicky brain, you know, every now and then, the little nitpicky part of me that goes, you know, the sound effects are not, or like the sound mixing's not as great. Like, some of the, like, lines of dialogue don't match with the lip sync.
Yeah.
Or some of the sound effects don't really, like, sound like the things that are happening on screen. But I mean, that movie for me is just utter perfection.
Yeah. I know people like would think I'm crazy for this, but I actually prefer Jurassic Park over Jaws. But the thing is, I tell people though, it really is the same movie. It's just not the same movie, but there's no difference. I mean, it's just, I just enjoyed Jurassic Park watching it as a kid. So it's just nostalgia, I think. They're all great movies, so.
And I don't blame people for that. I don't, because I mean, Jurassic Park is a lot, like, there is a huge nostalgia attached to it. It also, Jurassic Park is, you know, it's just a fun movie to watch. Like, I mean, so is Jaws, but Jurassic Park, I mean, you can sit there and watch that movie on a loop. Whereas Jaws, you would probably get tired every now and then of, like, you would probably go insane of hearing the Jaws scene. But Jurassic Park, it's like, it's got the right music, it's got the right color palette, it's got the perfect blend of CGI and practical effects. It's just, you know, Jurassic Park is just, you know, it's a very well-made movie, so I don't blame people for loving that more than Jaws. And Jaws has, you know, it had a, you know, horrendous production history, so I can understand if people are finding flaws in it. I can understand if someone went through, a comb and just finding flaws in it or finding continuity errors in it. I can understand that. Like, I can understand people finding flaws, but Raiders, Schindler's List, I'll get into it one day, but I really love the shit out of Munich.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll get into it one day.
Yeah, not to go off on a tangent about Spielberg, but Minority Report's in my top five. That's, I think, his all-time most underrated movie. Well, it's not underrated, actually, because it's critics liked it, but it's kind of got forgotten. It's kind of been forgotten over the course of time. I think it's probably one of my all-time favorite science fiction movies, too. So,
yeah, that's weird, because, I mean, last I checked, and while I'm talking, I'll look it up, but last I checked, it had a 96%.
Oh, yeah,
on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah. Yeah, I just mean it's not as iconic as the rest of them, though. Like, when you think of Spielberg, when I think of Spielberg, I think of Minority Report, actually, as weird as that sounds. It's one of the movies I think of, because I watched it as a kid, and I really enjoyed it. It's one of those, it's actually, speaking of movies that scare kids, that was one of the ones that scared me as a kid. That, like, was one of the few movies I saw as a kid that really pushed the boundaries. So it's kind of, you know, holds a solid place in my heart in terms of that. But it's one of my favorites by him, though. So.
It's actually a 90 on Rotten Tomatoes. My bad.
Yeah, which is still pretty good, though. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No diss on it. But, yeah, I mean, Munich was, like, I think it was my first, other than the E.T., like, 20th anniversary, that was my first Spielberg movie in theaters, Munich.
Munich? Wait, when did you see it in theaters? Yeah.
I saw it when it came out, and that was, like...
Really? Wow.
2006?
It was 2005, yeah. So you were 10 or 9?
I was 11.
Wow.
I was 11 when I saw it. And
that's an intense movie to watch as a kid.
Oh, yeah. And I really dug it. I really loved it. Watching it older, as an older person, it still is like an intense movie. And I'll get into it more. I'm saving Munich for a bigger Steven Spielberg podcast, but I love Munich. It is just, a lot of people love Lincoln for it being like this really, you know, timely political thriller. But Munich for me is like the timely political thriller that Spielberg made that's fantastic.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I think so too. I just can't get over the fact that you saw it when you were 11. Did it scar you for like the next year after that?
No, because after that I saw The Departed, and then
wow,
and then I went on like a kind of an R-rated binge after that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I started getting to R-rated movies when I was like 12 or 13. But yeah, I just
well, it's I mean, funny I, to think about. Well, yeah. I mean, I saw like Predator and Terminator when I was like eight and nine. So
yeah, but even Terminator is pretty innocent compared to Munich. I mean,
Oh, yeah. I mean, Munich has, like, a scene where someone's making love to their wife while crying.
Oh, that's not what I was thinking of. I was thinking of the stabbing in the head and the blowing up people. And, like, actually, like, I mean, there's some disturbing, the violence is really intense in Munich.
It is. I mean, I argue it's even sometimes more intense than anything in Saving Private Ryan or in most of Spielberg's work.
Oh, I think so too. Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't feel like a Spielberg movie. There is no Spielbergian moment in Munich, actually. It's interesting because Because
there's a couple oners in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. I think there's no moment though where like I know in Saving Private Ryan, it's kind of a spoiler, but I think everybody's seen it, where, you know, the guy at the end, Matt Damon's character, when he's aged, he asks, you know, did I earn it? You know, there's that whole moment where he looks back and he's in the cemetery. And there's moments like that in Saving Private Ryan and even Schindler's List, but in Munich, there really is no like hero. There is, I mean, the heroes are the main characters, but they are, there's so, it's three-dimensional, you know, it doesn't feel like a Spielberg movie. You know what I mean? It's interesting that way.
Yeah. And even the ending, I think it's the only Spielberg movie that doesn't end like on an ambiguous note.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, almost all the Spielberg movies kind of end on a, like, everything's tied up in a bow and everything's nice. But
yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. Yeah.
But Munich is that one movie that's like, you know, it ends on, you know, a note of, you know, on a question mark. And for me, that's what makes it so much more powerful.
Yeah.
So going back to E.T.
Yeah, we got kind of off on a tangent there. Yeah.
So after E.T., this, and Poltergeist to an extent, like I feel like we would be, you know, doing injustice if we didn't give Poltergeist some credit. But after Poltergeist and E.T. doing very, very well at the box office, we got, you know, the whole slew of Amblin movies like Joe Dante's Gremlins, Richard Donner's The Goonies, Young Sherlock Holmes, Back to the Future. Am I missing any that came out in the 80s that were more Amblin productions? Back to the Future sequels.
I can't remember. I mean, I know what Amblin Productions is, but I can't remember the movies they've made. I never looked it up, so yeah.
Right. I mean, they've done other movies. I noticed that I actually remember recently doing, because I'm now starting to do research for my other podcast, that I just remember that Spielberg actually produced Men in Black. And okay. So, yeah, he was involved in that movie. And so, yeah, it's all really interesting where Spielberg's trajectory has went and then where it's gone, you know, after Jurassic Park. And I think one day, I'm thinking when he does Ready Player One, or when he releases it, I think that's going to be the time when we do the Spielberg podcast for the Youth Critic.
Yeah.
Because that'll pretty much be like his, because that's pretty much, if you've read the book and if you understand Spielberg at all and know that he's directing the movie, essentially it's going to be like his way of cementing his legacy. Essentially. If he can get that movie working. That's if he can get that movie to work.
Yeah, I guess so. In some ways it would be. Because it's an individual.
Yeah, so. Sorry, what would you say?
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, because it's an adventure movie along the same tone as his earlier 80s movies, so I can see that. Yeah.
So, with that said, do we have any more final thoughts on E.T.? Because I could ramble on some particular scenes that I love, but Brandon, you're the bigger E.T. fan, so go on your tangent about, like, on your final tangent about E.T.
Oh, I can't think of much more to say. I mean, if I had seen it recently, I could probably think of something else. I saw it recently, like 2 years ago at the theater. Let's see, E.T. Yeah, that's about it. The comedy, you know, it's funny. There's a lot of funny moments, but it's not slapstick. It's not forced, you know. It's just kids being kids, you know, funny moments like that. Like the Halloween sequence.
They try to dress up. Or the pizza scene at the beginning.
Yeah, pizza scene, yeah. And, you know, like the kids, it's another one of those movies back then where the kids actually acted like kids. They behaved like kids do.
Isn't that odd? Kids, you know, acting like kids in a movie.
Yeah, it's just, it's funny, I'm not sure when that exactly ended, but if you watch E.T., The Goonies, Stand By Me, it's like, I mean, they recreated that with Stranger Things, you know, pretty well.
Right.
I saw an interview where they actually had those kids watch those movies. They actually had to watch Stand By Me and The Goonies. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. That's really cool. So as far as, are you done with on ET?
Yeah, I think I'm done. Yeah, I can't think of much else since. Yeah.
I'll point out one more scene that I really love, one scene that I really love a lot, and that is when Michael kind of introduces his mom to ET, and she kind of giggles a bit because she's not sure how to take it. And then when she like fully grasps like what is going on with ET and Elliot, she panics and tries to get the kids out, and it's just a great moment. The music is swelling. It's swelling up to this very tragic and beautiful melody. And then as Michael and Gertie and the mom and Elliot are downstairs, the NASA astronauts just walk right in slowly. And it's just beautifully well shot.
Oh, it is. Yeah. And I was going to mention,
it's totally scary.
Yeah, the scariest moment for me as a kid watching it was the part where the astronaut appears. And even though astronauts technically aren't scary, it's just so odd to see an astronaut appear out of nowhere like that, like from the window. And that is just so freaky watching as a kid. And watching again as an adult, one of the best shots of the movie is when the whole tone of the movie shifts and you see the people walking down the street. And like the cop cars.
It is the best shot in the movie.
It is, because it's like the whole, you realize how serious it is, like how if an alien really did come to Earth, this would happen. They would have to quarantine the entire like neighborhood, basically. It's just fascinating.
And they did, like,
yeah.
Yeah, and it's just like totally like Earth change. Like, and it really shifts the tone well, because it's a moment when, you know, everything's, where shit's getting real, and the astronauts, you can't really see their faces. That makes it even more scary.
Yeah, yeah.
And they kind of just pop out like, and they, you know, just sound like Darth Vader. And I mean, they just kind of like pop out of nowhere. And the reason why it's so unsettling is because we're so used to them being on the moon or seeing them, you know, not in a home environment. That was wonderfully well set up in this movie. And so when the astronauts come by and you can't see their faces and they're just popping out of everywhere, it's like, it's both a violation of, you know, of the home, of like the home itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just in a total like tonal shift that works. Like, you know, Brandon and I were talking about The Mummy on the Youth Critic podcast for The Mummy. That movie owned the whole way through. Like, it just jumps here and here. It never has gradual tonal shifts.
Yeah.
Like, it's just multiple tones in one movie. Like, every scene has a different tone. And this one, it has a great gradual tonal shift that just shifts you into, you know, the oh shit part of this movie, which is E.T. dying. And then of course, you're beaten down so well, beaten down so harshly, that when E.T. does come back to life, even though it doesn't logically make sense, it still is like, you're just happy to get back into that earlier tone of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And a good example of how, like I can't pinpoint exactly what makes some movies, like the tonal shifts, like work. In some cases it doesn't. It depends on the movie. But I can say, though, if this was made by a more amateur director, or if it was made today, that after the astronauts come, or after the whatever organization, the CIA, NASA, whatever, after they come and quarantine the house, what would have happened in a modern day movie made by a lesser director would have been a montage of CNN clips and like news headlines about an alien coming to Earth, you know, like that's the kind of tonal shift that wouldn't have worked. But I remember in ET, the only thing you see outside, it keeps it on the house, and you see the neighborhood kids watching in awe, basically. That's really the only thing they do to show outside people watching this happen. They don't go over the top, you know, they don't, like, that's the kind of good choice that Spielberg made. He kept it isolated in the house and in the neighborhood from the kids' perspective. Well,
right, and I think he kind of had to, because, again, I forgot to mention this in the production history, but for its time, E.T. had a low budget of $10 million.
Yeah.
So I think Spielberg kind of did have to. So I think Spielberg, you know, and I can't remember Close Encounters that well, but I think there was TV footage and TV news footage in the movie. I want to say there was. But then again, I have not seen Close Encounters in like 10 or 12 years. So...
Close Encounters hasn't aged as well as the other ones. It's still a good movie, but it's not like in my top 10 for Spielberg. So,
right. But you know, I think he kind of just had to because of budgetary reasons. And also from an editing standpoint, it doesn't make any sense to bring in news footage. It just doesn't. Well,
that's what I'm saying, though. Yeah. I'm saying that
other directors. More fat in the movie.
Yeah, other directors would have done that. I mean, he made a lot of choices that other directors wouldn't have. Like, other directors probably would have introduced, they would have introduced Peter Coyote in the very beginning or somewhere in halfway through the film. They would have done a lot of things that Spielberg didn't do. But anyway, yeah.
Even Stranger Things makes that mistake by revealing Matthew Modine's character pretty early.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not really a mistake, but it's a different kind of movie than E.T. But yeah, that's the kind of choices most directors would have gone with.
Sure. I mean, it's not as much of a critique as much of an observation. We're talking about it.
Yeah.
So I think we're done with. So I think you and I have talked E.T. and kind of teased a Spielberg podcast down the road. A lot. So, are you ready to move on?
Yeah, I think we're probably done. I can't think of much else to say.
All right. So that is it for the youth. So that is it for the Youth Critic Retrospective this week. You can find me at Movie Kale, and then you can find me at the Youth Critic, and then you can also follow this channel. That's where I distribute all my podcasts at KHC Network. And if you go on Podbean or iTunes, look up KHC Network and write us a review and tell me and tell Brandon and tell everyone else that's been on this show how we're doing. And that is it for our show this week. Brandon, do you have any plugins?
Nope.
Okay. And as far as retrospectives go, I don't know when the Thing podcast will happen. I'm still trying to figure out who can be on it and who can't. But as far as the Mummy and It Comes at Night podcast will be up later today, whenever this, you know, comes up. I think it's up on Wednesday. This and the Mummy podcast will be up on Wednesday. But yeah, that's it for, so you're getting two episodes released on Wednesday, and then sometime next week we'll have the Thing podcast, and then we'll have a podcast review of Riverdale, the new CW show that everyone's telling me to watch. So, well, not Brandon, but everyone else I know. But Brandon, I know I ask you this, and you never say yes. But do you have any Twitter handles or things that people want you to follow?
Not really. Nope.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, if I ever get that YouTube channel going up again, maybe someday, but.
All right. I only ask, it's a courtesy thing. That's why I ask.
Yeah.
All right. So that is it, everyone. Thanks for listening in, and we'll be back with you next week.
Something. 12 men have just discovered something. For 100,000 years, it was buried in the snow and ice. Now it has found a place to live. Inside. Where no one can see it. Or hear it. Or feel it.
I know I'm human. Some of you are still human. This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation. It'll fight if it has to. But it's vulnerable out in the open. If it takes us over, then it has no more enemies. Nobody left to kill it.